Today's episode is What's Up with This Job Market, where everyone's hiring and everyone wants to work.
Resilient, durable, robust, use the word you want to use.
The job market is absolutely solid.
I believe we can work from anywhere.
We went from help wanted everywhere and remote jobs galore to return to the office mandates and pink slips.
Over 20,000 tech workers have lost their jobs so far this year.
The latest, Google cutting hundreds of jobs.
And it could also be the beginnings of a massive labor shift.
We're going to unpack the why behind the what, a phrase inspired by the brilliant Dr. Christina Serrano, one of my largest guests here. She is changemaker, professional faculty, a professor at UC Berkeley. She also works at Stanford. I'll let her tell you a little bit more about these exciting courses that she teaches and all of the work that she's doing to really celebrate, elevate, and upskill Gen Z and adjacent generations who may be so lucky to be in her class. And then we've also got Tony Blything, experienced design leader at Johnson Controls and one of the most amazing collaborators I've had the pleasure of working with. I met Tony a couple of years ago on a learning experience platform implementation, and I'm hoping that things are still running smoothly with this sort of next generation learning experience that we helped roll out. And fun fact about Tony, I'll let him tell you a little bit more about that. He's a priest. I find that he's also a very good listener. So without further ado, I am going to turn it over to my wonderful, wonderful guests to start telling you a little bit more about themselves. First, we're going to start with our vibe check. Christina, Dr. Serrano, what is your favorite hip hop song?
It is That's How I Knew or Overtime by Nipsey Hussle.
Tony, your turn.
Actually, Rabbit's Revenge. Look up that one. That's a collaboration with Tom Morello and Run the Jewels.
Oh my gosh, Killer Mike, who won like all of these Grammys, like just came back from obscurity. I think all of the music heads knew how amazing he was, but it was a sweep for this guy. Okay, so Tom Morello, Rabbit's Revenge. And then my favorite. I love the collaboration between the different styles, which is what kind of brings me now into our questions. I want to first put the spotlight on corporations.
There are four serious problems that suggest the U.S. jobs market isn't as strong as it seems.
I've witnessed inflation the last 4 years. That wasn't caused by workers. It was caused by two words, corporate greed.
So going back to this market that we're in, there was a recent Inequality Inc. report that caught my eye. This was conducted by Oxfam, and they're a nonprofit focused on eradicating poverty. And they found U.S. corporate practices are complicit in widening the inequality footprint. So what I would love to hear from each of you what's your reaction to this hypothesis that we're in a job market where multiple generations of workers are struggling to find work while profits are soaring?
I'll let you go first, Christina.
Ooh. I absolutely agree that, you know, corporations are complicit in further exacerbating inequality. I teach courses at UC Berkeley, and in my education course, we actually absolutely dive into this. And we critique, right, like the workforce, the economic relationships of production kind of stuff, right? We get into that like abstract stuff, but then we start thinking about, well, what role do we play in helping to perpetuate these things? And how do we think critically about the job markets we're entering into and what role we have to play in redirecting, these trends. I think it's so important to empower students to think critically about their role in shaping a more equitable future. And I think the education system is, as the report talks about, it's seen as a great equalizer and a key tool in fighting to reduce economic and gender inequality. But the global education system, United States education system, is highly underfunded and completely under pressure in terms of all the things we ask it to do to address equity that really belongs in the realm of like economic and social policy. But we keep putting that into schools, which to me is like, is a way to sort of pass the buck and part of like the whole collusion that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, no, I want to add, like, I agree and add to that. Like, I think, we're seeing the student debts just rise, like the crisis of that. And higher education is becoming more and more unattainable for a larger and larger portion of our society, because it's really hard to justify going to college and knowing that I'm going to come out with like $100,000 in debt even before I've even had my first job. So it's making it that only the wealthy can afford to go to college and have that experience, because they're the only ones who can offset some of those costs. I mean, I think we all can speak to friends who, about friends, I have friends who are, they can't even, they're making their payments every month, but their interest is so high that they're actually, it's getting bigger and bigger. Like their debt is getting higher and higher. They're not paying anything off. So I think that's leading to a greater, we've already got really wealthy and poor, and there's no middle class. So I think you're seeing the education system. I'm in a unique position because I don't know if you'll see me on camera or not, but I'm white, I'm a man, and kind of we had our chance. That's kind of my perspective. Like, we had our chance. We created a system. This is the system we created. It's not working great. I can't be involved in any new system. Like, the only thing I can do is be an ally, as support. Because if it's a hypocrisy, and it's just like me playing up my guilt that somehow I need to be the person who builds the next system. It's just still white male building the next system. So I'm, as a priest, that was always really important to me. Like, injustice was a big deal to me. I started a church in the city, in the only neighborhood of my city that was integrated. And it was a big deal to me. There's a guy in education, he's a sociologist, and he talks about the ecology of human development. It blew my mind. He says, we live in circles, groups of people, and you have like your immediate circle of people is your family, and they have the greatest influence. And then maybe your extended family has the next. Then maybe it's your block, or your church is another influence. But the further you get out, the less influence they have on people. And so that's why I wanted to move into the city, is because I think this is why diversity is important at work too. This is why I think diversity is important everywhere. Is if you've only surrounded by people like you, you're hearing one story. You're hearing, this is just the story. This is how life goes. This is what family's like. This is how you do this. But if you live in an integrated society with people coming from different backgrounds, or you work in a place with people coming from different backgrounds, or you work on a team that have different backgrounds, you start to realize that you have a lens, and you have a certain gaze at which you see things, and you have to at least acknowledge that other people see it differently. And I think that that's part of the problem, is we're not curious. We're not curious, like our leadership is not curious to why it's happening. They're not stepping back and kind of using their third eye. They're not like being curious about themselves and how they're responding in situations, and willing to maybe challenge their assumptions. It's because there's too much pressure. Like, there's just too much pressure to get it right. And so they, and that's just never a good place to lead from either. Right. If you're living under all the pressure and stress, like, you know, competency impacts character. All that to say is, like, there's other models that we could learn from other people, but we don't seem to be in a place of curiosity as a society right now. We seem to be in a place of defense. And like our posture towards everything is, here's my stance, what do you think? Very attacking, very guarded, very protected. And there's not a social dialogue that's happening.
Yeah. tensions are running high.
Well, you could say that.
Yeah.
Especially as we move closer to November.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of those tensions. I found it really interesting. And for those who are able to experience the podcast on more visual platforms like YouTube, I can pull up a few of these articles. I've seen numerous, you know, TikTok, X accounts, millennials, Gen Z, What Layoff is actually an account that's run by layoffs.fyi. Absolutely love what they do. And they kind of help to warn. They publish warn notices, which are public, but I feel like it's easy to overlook if you're not in a state that has a whole lot more disclosure requirements around the WARN Act. Some, I don't know what the number of states are, but for example, California, New York, Illinois, I believe there's some states that do have supplemental requirements for like what companies must disclose around upcoming plant closures, mass layoffs, that sort of thing, right? Things that are disruptive to people and their lives.
There were absolutely no signs from the company that it was going to happen.
When I first heard the news, I kind of didn't know how to feel.
Hi, Brittany.
Hi.
Thanks for meeting with me and Rosie. We have an important meeting today. We've decided to part ways with you.
Yeah, I'm going to stop you right there.
So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this social media phenomenon where millennial and Gen Z talent are detailing their layoff and their job search experiences with unprecedented candor. It almost feels like the follow-on to quiet quitting, then loud quitting, and now I guess it's sort of like loud layoffs. I'm not sure if anyone's put a name to it, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on this phenomenon and what narratives you see in your own personal network.
I have four kids. And I have a 15-year-old daughter who's like, I don't know. I mean, it's like her whole life is recorded. It's really interesting to watch like this comfort with speaking to your camera like it's a person, right? Like I'm having a conversation with the camera. I'm not recording something. I'm actually talking to my friends as if they're right there. And, you know, these would be the conversations she would have. So if she's going to cry on camera, she'll like create a 5-minute video crying because she can't, you know, find her favorite lip gloss or whatever it is, or her drunk elephant, something, some type of perfume. And it's a very comfortable thing. So I think some of it is, it ends up becoming almost like a protest kind of thing, but I don't think it's intended that way. Like, I think it's just like, this is how I do life. My life is recorded. I share it with my friends. I put it on my socials because that's how I stay in touch with my people. But the implications of it is that we're seeing things that maybe we never would have seen before because we're being invited into conversations that they're having with their friends. Because I don't think my daughter's doing it because she wants the world to see it. But she's just not thinking like, oh, but actually other people could and will see this. I'm sure some people are doing it. Like, they're influencers. They want to do it. They want. But I think a lot of it is just, this is how we communicate now, and I don't care who hears it.
Yeah.
What do you think, Christine?
No, I absolutely agree. It's definitely the culture, right, of this particular generation, and the fact that the social learning, the social interaction realm is through these kinds of platforms, and expression is through, you know, these shorts and reels. And Gen Z is just candid in general, in terms of my experience, and really good at telling the BS, I guess you could say, and not necessarily like playing into it. It reminds me, right, of sort of how we think about, I might get techy here, apologies, but I'm thinking about like virtual reality and like Apple's, you know, new virtual reality headsets and this idea of virtual computing and how we interface like with their headset, you're still seeing the physical environment and you're seeing the virtual environment, and we're starting, and sort of that augmented reality, that life of engaging in virtual and physical realms at the same time, just really part of how Gen Z does life. And I think this like sort of like showcasing my day in life or this particular experience is part of this integrated virtual and physical reality that is just going to continue to become more sophisticated. And so it doesn't surprise me that, you know, that our young people are showcasing what's happening to them. But to Tony's point, I don't know that they're necessarily seeing it as like an act of protest or an act of like political statement, which I think is important to say to them, hey, this is great as a larger public dialogue that you're helping to facilitate, to support their ability to think about it as a form of pushing back on what's happening.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, because I mean, that's the thing, that's why we should be in relationship and dialogue, and because they might not be aware of implications of what might be happening by posting those videos. Like, what is the employer going to think if I stumble across this and I want to hire you? But now I'm like, well, what if I don't? You want to go in with eyes wide open that when I post this stuff, like there are things, you know, like, because I may be posting like let's say it is somebody who's not posting because they're trying to be protesting or whatever, and they're an introverted human, or they're a more reserved human just in general. If they were to know that, if they were to think through that, they may not want to do that. Like they may not, because they would be uncomfortable, because they wouldn't want to say that maybe to an employer or something like that. So I love that it's happening. I think what you're seeing is, and Christina, as an educator, you know, like the real learning happens in the reflection, like deep learning happens in that metacognition, the stepping back and thinking about what I was thinking about. And so it's almost a way of their processing, they're learning themselves by recording themselves, talking about their experience, whether they know it or not. Like it's forming their opinions about what they will do next time and how they approach certain things. And so it's, when you said social learning, I'm like, yeah, that's probably a piece of it. It's, this is them, we're getting an inside look at what reflection and deep learning is looking like for them and what they're taking away from these experiences, which is really kind of fascinating.
I like that they're also leveraging the platform to call out bad behaviors on the part of corporations. Yeah. I think Barbarian is intentionally doing that when they're recording the layoff process. And I love it because it's like they're putting it on Twitter, they're putting it on IG, and like everybody gets to join that conversation about like, was this good practice? And then you have like, I watched one where it was like a Cloudflare employee, right? Like going through the process of like two HR people who they never knew jumping on the line and saying, okay, your performance was not right, and et cetera. And she's kind of pushing back on that. But Cloudflare then had
I saw that one.
Yeah, that like they had to respond, right? They had to say, oh, well, okay, it wasn't a mistake that we let this employee go. It was more so the mistake of how we chose to lay people off. And I think, you know, it's interesting because like those mass layoffs via Zoom and or just like these weird ways of doing it, it's kind of like pandemic driven, how we sort of shifted into this different world during pandemic and how that's sort of still lingering. But I think it's good that they're calling out sort of like this practice of how they're kind of dehumanizing labor and workforce. And saying like it's messed up, like that I don't even get like the decency of like my manager telling me to my face, you're gonna have to like go, right? That it's just like everybody on the Zoom call, you're fired.
Yeah.
Like what? The other thing I wanted to note, there's a professor at Stanford, his name is Jeffrey Pfeffer, and he does a lot of courses on power. And he talks, I was at an executive program that was on HR leaders, and he said, you know, the thing that sucks is when we go, when one company starts to lay off, it's like it's a contagion. And that's what all the other companies start to do. And there's not even necessarily about, you know, bottom line or any of these other reasons you might think about why you would lay off people. It's just this sort of like, well, they're doing it. And it's about like this power exchange and trying. And you were talking about earlier, to me, is like how it's trying to consolidate power, go back into like the employer has the power to dictate terms. And so I think we're seeing this kind of like power struggle between, you know, the workers and the owners of companies, and how we make strides in like, you know, oh, I want to work from home, or I want these benefits, or I want to, this is what's important to me. And employers being like, no, I want you to do this, or I want, you know, to be able to like give you a lower wage, or it's a lot about power going on here too.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know, digital transformation in general, the topic is the idea of a company needing to change to still be successful and make money in a new economy, in a new market. And a lot of that means maybe changing some of their analogical ways of doing things to become digital, right? And the emphasis is on digital transformation. What's, I mean, interesting statistics out there is about 70% of companies that try to digitally transform fail. The reason why they fail is because they put an emphasis on digital, right? On let's get all of the right systems, all the right tools and technologies in place, and then all of a sudden we'll be digitally transformed. But nobody thinks about the transformation piece.
Like, right? Training gets cut, but I feel like transformation budgets are still intact. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
If you say you're transforming instead of training, and maybe that, you know, in terms of just telling a different story or pivoting, you know, our skills backpack into something that feels palatable. Like, it's the same skills, right? It's the same backpack, but I do think that stories are becoming really important. Even in the sort of pre-gaming before we went live here, we were talking about just how important human connection is going to be the more impersonal AI, you know, sort of makes our interactions, because it is dry and sterile. It feels to me, the idea that an employer can ghost a candidate, because the funny thing is there are automatic tasks that you can put into these platforms where you can automate the closure, right? You can close the engagement out. But that's just me, you know, sort of with my more detail oriented. I'm like, well, you can ghost, just do it with like digital compassion. And it kind of blows my mind. It's like, you can't even fake it. Like, why don't you just fake compassion? Because paradoxically, AI actually does make it easier to automate so many more of these processes. And I think that's what's baffling, you know?
Yeah. Well, and so that point about the transform point, it's about the people, right? Why digital transformation doesn't work is because you don't step back and say, what is the processes that our people do? What is their day-to-day life? What are their interactions like? And if we want to keep the good interactions, the good experience, the good journey of our employees, if we want to still keep the same kind of culture, we need to understand where the technology weaves into that and transform the way we do business so that these tools enable and enhance our humanity instead of like make us dehuman.
Right? Like, it can help.
I love that. These tools enhance our humanity. I love digital compassion. I love that. You know, it's interesting because ChatGPT, when you talk to it, it's actually programmed to talk to you as a human, to emulate like the human approach. And yet, to your point, T, like, why are we not adding these compassionate layers into these digital transformations or these digital engagements with our very human force?
Barbie told us why.
Yeah.
I mean, we just don't need to go watch Barbie
What did Barbie say, Tony?
I mean, Barbie is like Greta Gerwig's Trojan horse. I took both of my boys separately to go to that movie. I think it's critical. But I think what you're getting at is, you can't separate the fact that we have a patriarchal society that's full of toxic masculinity and lacks any emotional intelligence. I see it all of the time. Like, people, I mean, so like I said, I was a priest, and I think I didn't try to, but I think in some ways I would show up to work kind of in that persona of a priest. That's just how I approach people. It's ask questions, be compassionate, be curious, understand where they're coming from. And that, so it taught me a lot about emotional intelligence. And I think what we're seeing is, if you don't have emotional intelligence, like if you've got all the tools that are efficient, all of that, like, who cares? Like, if you're hurting people in the process, like, that's to me the biggest frustration, is when I just see such a lack of social intelligence from our leadership and how some of these things are rolled out. Because like you said, yeah, the technology actually could help us. We could create a whole new layoff experience that could be transformative, right? Like, there's no reason why we couldn't. Why couldn't a layoff actually be an inflection point in my life that could push me into the next thing, the next level thing? Why does it have to be something that has to be like such a, like, communicating to me that I'm not important, communicating to me that I'm not a valuable. Like, why couldn't we step back and say, well, we want you to feel this way. And so what language would enhance that or help it instead of like what we currently do?
I love that, that whole reframing.
Yeah.
I was participating on a panel on AI and how it's shaping the future of higher education. And one of the things I ended with was, you know, AI is a reflection of us and our behavior, right? It's our data. You're talking about it's going to destroy this, it's going to destroy that, and it's doing this and it's doing that. It's like, no, that's us.
Yeah.
Reflecting us and our decisions and our choices, right, around how we would choose to deploy it and use it and train it's training on us. And so if it's more of a structural issue and it's more of a problem about us that we need to
move on.
And that's a perfect example of, like, you literally could train it to say, how do we spin this in a positive way where there was growth, you know, trajectory out of this shift and transition from, okay, this is not working and we've got to let you go for all these reasons, but you're awesome, right? And there's all these skills that you can then take, like, how could it literally leverage, like, supporting someone to take, like, account of all that they've been able to do their job and say, here's all that you were able to do here and how you contextualize this for your next space. Like, how do we leave people gifts leveraging this technology that would be harder to do as a human, right? But why not? Why aren't we thinking this way? So I love that reframing of it.
Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, I just would love to see our society become a little kinder, a little bit kinder.
I think we're talking more about it, and I don't know, maybe we have Gen Z to thank for that.
Gen Z is
they are not having it, you know, like they're not with, they're, you know, I don't want to curse on air here, but they are not with the they are not with the BS. I think that it's a great, the sort of outcry, right? Going back to, you know, sort of the last topic and bringing it forward to this idea of them challenging, you know, employers not to be sterile and do it as you've always done it. And I have to make sure I do this before we go off air, but I think it's so important in my personal journey. I enjoyed so much working for David Hill at Udacity. And that's how me and Dr. Christina Serrano crossed paths. And I think what bothers me most about this disruption that we're in, because that's the only thing I can only call it that. They won't say we're in a recession. Apparently the economy's great. The economy, it's great. We're adding jobs every day. Like, that's the voice that I hear the news people in, like weird cartoon character just saying gibberish. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, because it's not just certain people hurting and displaced. It's a lot. And I have to say what upset me the most, I came to a point where I crafted my career and found my home in ed tech and found my village and what I love doing. Even when I was an architect, I always built schools, and it took me years to sort of get closer and closer to the center of the pit stop, right? And I think the tragedy of all this disruption is that folks like me who, you know, maybe there's folks who were like, I didn't like that job anyway, but it still sucks that I was laid off. I hated being separated from such a good leader because it takes years. And I whenever he listens to this, you know, I reached out to him so much. We were talking about this earlier, right? And I feel like may not cross paths with him. I don't know if he's in San Diego or Carlsbad. That's something that is, I don't know if Gen Z is running into that yet. But at my stage, right, I have really taken my time. And while some of us are in different stages, you know, I love what I did, and I lost my manager before I too was then impacted. But I hate that for people who have done that work, done that really hard sort of soul searching to kind of figure out what do you like, what do you not like, how do you advocate, how do you ask for what you need, and you kind of find, you know, all these things come together. And now a lot of us, you know, are starting over. Like, I'm doing contracts and podcasts, and it's fun and kind of adventurous, but I have to say, like, there is a hole in my heart.
I just want to highlight or underline what you said, because I hadn't thought about, you know, layoffs in this way. We have mutual boss, you know, a boss here, David Hill. And I, when I went into Singularity, we had just like a fantastic team, just like one of the best teams I've ever been a part of, and some of the best people I've ever gotten to work with and got to know, who became friends. And I never thought of layoffs and the disruption that causes as this kind of disruption to human connections. Right. So when we think continuously about sort of like work and what that means and how it shapes identity, and then also like the relationships you have, it becomes even more of a call to action that we need to get better about how we hire and fire, or the kinds of cultures we create, because there are human relationships and ties that happen in doing the work together.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Christina, like, I mean, obviously older generations, there's me at work, and then there's me at home. There's like, you know, like the Apple TV show is at Severed, where you put in a chip, you don't even know what you do at work, because your brain shuts off and doesn't. And when you don't even know at home if you're married or single or whatever, like they're so separate. But how, like, my hypothesis or my hunch is that life is not viewed that way for younger people. There's not like my work life, my home life, my social life. It's just like, this is my life, period, right? These are my people, you know, and in my former career, that was the way it was. Like, as a priest, it's like my community was my job. Like, my people was my job. So gathering people together, like you're meeting with people, talking to them, there wasn't like this. So I just brought that into my corporate life. Like, without even realizing it, just assuming like there is no dichotomy. This is just my life. Like, I work whenever my people need me. Like, I can work at night. I don't care. I can work on the weekends. It's fine, because these are my people. And so, well, I mean, obviously COVID changes it a lot, but as a male, it's not easy to build community. It's not easy to make friends. It's not easy to do that. And so it's a significant thing when you're telling somebody like, yeah, this is your life, but we're going to take this part of your life away from you.
Yeah.
Like we're cutting off we're cutting off a part of you. And so, I mean, if you come into a layoff from that perspective, like a part of you is dying today, and I'm the one who has to bear that news. Like, there's a need for compassion. And since we're calling out people, I will say, like, in a recent, because I've also experienced the joy of layoff.
Joy.
And so I kind of knew it was coming. I'm a strategic thinker. I could kind of see, like, just the way that I was positioned in my company, that if I'm a strategic leader looking at me, I look like I'm just like this floating amoeba out there in the midst of this organization. No direct manager, no people under me. Seems like an easy cut. So I knew it was coming. I think my director knew it was coming. We were talking. And so all of a sudden, Thursday night, I get a meeting put in my calendar for, you know, I have a 30-minute meeting with my director. And I'm like, oh, okay, here it comes. Because I knew. And so I get on the phone and split screen, and there's an HR person on one side and my director's on the other. I'll try not to cry. And she couldn't even, she lasted like 3 seconds. She's like, I can't do it. Like, she's just in tears and hung up. And then, you know, the HR person stays on and she's kind of like, she doesn't know what to do. And she's like, I've never seen that. And so, cause she's like, Tony's like one of my favorite people. Like, I, so to me, it was like a very human experience. But that's the way it can be. Like, it doesn't have, you can, like, you can grieve as an employer that you have to let people go. You don't have to come in afraid that, like, I think that some of it, we're so driven by fear. We're just like, and when we're afraid, we don't want to give any clue that this hurts us in any way. And then, but that was, I mean, that was a gift in my layoff. And then preceding days of people hearing, I mean, I had so many people, I ended up staying 30 days longer because I had people like, no, this can't, I need you. Like, I need you on this team. Like, eventually the chief HR officer had to, you know, gave me an extension for 30 more days. And so that experience was actually super validating and really encouraging because I had
a director. It's rare. That is rare.
Right. It's so rare, but it can happen. And what that ends up doing is you can leave then feeling like, I mean, so many people saying like, I'm so excited for what's next for you. Like, I mean, you're, it's not like you're going to find something else. It's just like, what are you going to choose? Like, just so many people like encouraging me and letting me know it's going to be okay. Like, so I left like not feeling like there's something wrong with me. Right. But I think a lot of people, that's the impression you get when you leave in a layoff. There's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with the way I do things. And that's just not it.
Yeah.
And Christina,
no, I was just thinking that, like, thank you for sharing that experience, and it makes me value the sharing online that's been happening, because I think it's really an important conversation to have these kind of vulnerable expressions of like that feeling that you are somehow, you know, not good enough as a human, or that you're less valued because you had a layoff. So like destigmatizing layoff and demanding more compassion and just integrity and ethics around how you treat employees, right? And so it's like, sure, it can be understandable that, you know, things are happening such as a pandemic and therefore you have to lay people off, right? If you've explored other options, but how can we endeavor to just be more, like from the initial part of the conversation, kind? Like, how can we infuse that in our work, in how we manage people, or in the future of work? Because it's important, and it's to your point that like as AI or things could become increasingly automated, like that skill set needs to be developed. I think it's weird to say, hey, we need to develop like people's skills to be kind. I was listening to something, I'm forgetting what it is, but I guess humans have this tendency to lie, like every 10 minutes or something like that. It's like something we do. We just lie about like the smallest of things. Like, oh, those kicks are cool. And it's like, no, man, so bad. Right? Like, we do like things to us. And it's interesting because supposedly that happens our limbic system, and it's actually really bad for us. So we need to learn how to, there's an author of a book called Radical Conversations, which really gets into like, or radical conversations or honesty about how can we learn how to be honest with one another, but in a way that is compassionate and kind and that is generative as opposed to like reductive. And so like, that's what I liked about that Cloudflare player video. Is she was like, let me stop you right there, right? Like when they're like, oh, you just, like they led with, well, we're letting you go because you haven't been performing, right? And she's like, let me stop you right there. Actually, I've done all these things, right? And pushing back on, that's the employer's, you know, position is we're going to let you go because of something you did, right?
Right.
And really trying to position the worker right? Or somebody who's given so much as the problem, as opposed to, I don't know, just being more authentic about what the realities of it.
And I do
especially
want to
when, yeah, especially
Dan, go ahead. We got Dan on the line, super vulnerable today. So we're busting stereotypes left and right. But go ahead, Tony.
I mean, what was I gonna say? What was your last point? Because I was like, I have ADHD.
Especially when
on her, right? It was that they were putting it on her as
they're making the individual the problem.
And in most states, it's like, you don't have to do that. You don't need a reason.
Yeah.
Right. There's no, like, if you want to be a jerk about it, be a jerk about it, but you don't even have to tell somebody, oh, you weren't performing. You can just say like, you don't have a job anymore. Like, if you want to be a jerk about it, just do that. You don't even have to give it an excuse. You're not required by law to give an excuse. So I don't even, there's something in us as humans, like, if you have to do that, then you should be questioning the layoff in the first place.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not here to sort of promote any one company. I've worked for a number of ed tech companies, but I will say, for those listening and maybe facing this, because I know we're coming up on time, I have one last question. Are y'all down for one more question? Okay. Sure. But I wanted to comment. And I learned this from a girlfriend of mine. She was a longtime UPSer. And I think UPS reminds me a lot of like Johnson Controls in terms of the culture. It may not be a university either, but I mean, there's some of these more steady institutions, right? That just kind of have a different posture around how they engage their talent. And I remember her telling me a story about, you know, someone just going through kind of like some life challenges, we'll say. She said, you know, she taught me to ask for what I wanted. And going back to mentioning, you know, finding a boss that I really enjoyed, I was really excited to be coming into the stage of my own career. And I know, Tony, you found a group of people who appreciated you and even wanted you to stay longer, right? Like they pressed the extension button on you because, you know, you are amazing. I loved working with you. And in my experience, what I found to be true about what my friend said from UPS is that you can ask, like they could say no, but you can ask for what you need. And I remember when I was impacted, I said, you know, I still want to learn. I still want to read The Economist. I still want to be able to go to Southwest. And I made a list of things and I went to HR. And at the time, I think I think he's still the CEO there, but he said yes. HR said yes. I took a note out of someone else's wellness, you know, playbook, and they said yes to me. And that girl at Cloudflare, probably that was not her mindset, right? But I had gotten to a place, and I think maybe as we come through this disruption and some of us find ourselves like reconnected in communities again, we can teach each other these little tricks. I learned in that moment that by just stepping out on faith and asking, based on what I heard someone get at UPS, which is a very different company, right? that maybe I could actually just get a little bit of a softer landing. I feel like this dovetails nicely with when you ponder the future of work, what parts are unsettling? Like I've just shared what parts of what we're dealing with inspire me. So I'm going to let y'all answer this question because we're limited on time. But when you ponder the future of work, what is unsettling, but what inspires you the most?
I think what's unsettling right now, as I prepare students for launching their next step in that future of work, is the rapid pace of change, right? Like, obviously AI is just one thing, but it's just every day there's more and more and more, and keeping up with it is already can be a little bit overwhelming, especially when you have so many things on your plate, right? So students have so many demands on their time. And so it's very unsettling, and supporting students in taking it in and being a part of shaping that future is really important to me. And I try and present to them that, hey, you know, it's unsettling, But it's such a great opportunity for innovation and reimagining work and education and how you know, you're part of shifting the future. So life doesn't just happen to you. Like, I think we feel that sometimes, that like all these things are just playing them out. Sure, we navigate constraints and some of us have more limitations than others and are completely, right? We're not in Palestine now, for example. And so I try and remember that. But at the same time, in the positions we're in, or Berkeley students in particular, I'm like, there's a privilege here. And you have an opportunity to shape the future in the way that you envision. And so there's so much possibility here, right? There's so much opportunity for you to decide what you want it to be, what you want it to look like, what you want it to look like. And so for me, it's an opportunity to say, like, question the status quo. Does it have to be that way? We've been taught that this is sort of normal, but is it normal? And yeah, that's why I'm also like, that inspires me, is the opportunity to say, how do we turn the tables and leverage these tools in ways that are more compassionate, that advance equity, that that are more like in alignment with what we want to see the world being, because we are collectively creating the world on a daily basis. We are complicit in our participation in those structures. And if you want to do something different, you have to, we have these things called the 3 C's and a change maker course. It's, you know, communication, collaboration, and critical thinking. And so that communication piece that you were just talking about, T, is like, I tell students all the time, hey, you have to, like, when you ask what you need about what's going on for you, you create space for others to both support you, but also feel comfortable in asking what they need. And then we become authentic jointly, and then we can be real about people, what's possible, or how do we shape what comes next, because we're being really authentic and honest about what we need to, like, continuously shutting those parts down. And it just creates an unrealistic world that we're all having to deal with together, and we're kind of like just battling each other. So anyway, unsettling, because it's, man, it's going fast, and it feels scary, but also super excited about what's possible.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Tony.
Well, I mean, we're clearly in the death throes of something. Like, there's something that's like really fighting to not go away. I don't know that I'm smart enough or thought much enough about it to know what those things are, but I think that's what we're seeing, is signs of something dying, the end of some type of age. And I think that makes it unsettling just internally, because if something's dying, what's going to replace it, and is it going to be any better or not? Like, so that can be kind of a scary proposition.
What was that book you mentioned in the earlier sort of
I'd have to. I'll have to go and look. What is her name? Phyllis? Is it Phyllis? She's the funniest name. It's like Phyllis Dittle or something. I'll have to go find the book for you. It's but basically, you know, when you're in these epical, like, we're in like a paradigmatic shift. Like, AI is making that even faster. It's changing the face of our society. We've unleashed it. There's no putting it back in the box. It's coming. It's just a part of it. That's just the reality, but we don't really know what's going to happen yet. Is it Sherry Turkle's got a TED talk? She was a director of self at MIT, the director of technology and self at MIT, and she said something that just stuck with me and has always stuck with me. And she's like, you know, we're treating our technologies like it's all grown up, but they're toddlers. Like, they're barely out of crawling, but we're letting this toddler tell us what it means to be human. We're letting technology form our humanity, when we should be stepping back and saying, what does it mean to be fully alive and fully human? And how do we create technology to enhance that and make us better? And I've just hung on to that because we can do that. And I think I'm also huge in like human-centered design and design thinking. So I think I love it's the way that it uses language to kind of open up possibility. And I want to be a society or people that's asking, how might we, instead of should we do this or should we not do this? You know, it's like, we don't need yes or no answers, and we don't need to know the right answer. We just need to try and know how, like, let's do something. It might work. It might not. And let's do it together. right? And right. So I think our language can help us move forward. I don't think there's nothing that you could do besides, unless you've got like medical doctors, you need a certain criteria, lawyer, you got to go past the bar, things like that. I'm like, why do my kids need to go to college? They could learn how to do all of this on their own. They could start. We're designing new business models all the time. Like, this is just a hyper creative time. And to me, I'm excited about that. Is maybe corporations aren't even a thing in the future. Like, who knows? Like, there's no reason why we have to assume that the things that are right now are the way that they'll be in the future. And that's a really fun, exciting place to be.
Well, yes. On that note, and it's all transcribed too. This is some rich stuff. I just want to thank the both of you for spending some extra time with me today to discuss what's up with this job market. And I want to pay it forward. I'm going to, at the end of every episode, if there's someone that donates something or wants to share a tidbit, my thing today is I want to remind everyone I have a collection of 200 free courses compiled at skillmatic.us/learn. So if you are in the midst of a career change, a pivot, a transition, or you're just curious, I always start with free resources. And you'll see a whole lot of providers listed there. And I really do wish you all of the best in your journey to a better and more exciting future of work.